Cyprus makes a deal, but what about the rest of Europe?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, good morning. I'm Mark Garrison in for Jeremy Hobson with the global perspective on business and economics. There is a deal in place for a $13 billion bailout of Cyprus. European diplomats reached it very, very early this morning after late-night talks. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joins us from London with the latest. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Mark.
So for those just waking up and perhaps didn't follow all the moves over the weekend, what are the key points of the deal in place?
Well, the crux of it is that smaller depositors in the two main Cypriot banks, people with under $130,000 in their accounts, won't lose any money. Bigger depositors, however, most of them foreigners, will have to cough up perhaps 40% or more of their money. This will help raise Cyprus's contribution to the bailout. The bailout can now go ahead. Cyprus's finance minister, Michael Tsiris, greeted the deal with relief.
We have averted the possibility of bankruptcy. We really avoided a disastrous exit from the Eurozone.
Okay, Stephen, is that it? Is that a problem solved?
No. Cyprus depends very heavily on its financial sector. That's been very badly damaged by all this. Russian depositors in particular are furious. It seems certain that when the banks reopen, there'll be a huge exodus of foreign cash, and it probably won't come back. Cyprus will have to find another source of income.
And very quickly, where does this leave us in terms of the euro crisis that, you know, many of us here in the States thought was under control until all this Cyprus stuff came around?
Well, the potential unraveling of the eurozone has been averted, but Moody's, in a note, has said there's been lasting damage to the eurozone because of the danger now that if another country gets into trouble, there'll be an immediate flight of capital by international depositors, afraid that they'll suffer big losses too.
Okay, more to watch. Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thanks.
Okay, Mark.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are up in global trading, European and Asian markets up on news of the Cyprus deal. On Wall Street on Friday, the S&P closed up 0.7%. The Dow rose 0.6% to close at 14,512.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Today, the president designates five new national monuments. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports on how communities around them want to cash in.
Among the new national monuments, part of the San Juan Islands in Washington State and a section of the Underground Railroad in Maryland.
The economics of parks is a lot like the economics of tourism.
Economist Jared Bernstein is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says visitors to these sites could give a boost to all kinds of local businesses.
Those people are going to spend some money in the parks. Maybe they'll buy some food, maybe some souvenirs.
A new monument in New Mexico, the Rio Grande del Norte, is expected to bring $15 million a year to the area. That's partly because Americans are starting to travel again, says Douglas Quinby, an analyst at Focusrite, a travel industry research firm.
The economy is definitely improving, so we are optimistic we're going to see some gains in 2013.
Still, it could be a rough year for parks. Many are expected to take a hit under the sequester budget cuts and will have to cut staff and reduce hours. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
High debt equals low growth. That is a widely held belief among the political class, supported by well-funded, bipartisan PR campaigns. But many economists just don't agree. And which camp is right has huge consequences for our economy. Bloomberg senior writer David Lynch has been looking at all sides of this debate and joins us from Washington. Hi, David.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Now, first, just give us a quick summary of the argument that debt is a drag on growth. How does it restrain growth in the opinion of those that make that case?
Well, there's a couple of ways. The traditional channel by which debt curbs growth is by the government's borrowing, crowding out private companies, raising interest rates, making it more expensive for them to borrow, and thus chilling economic activity. But the other argument, the more nuanced argument, is that even if you don't see it through that channel, the idea of this huge debt sort of looming in the background tells people that one of these days taxes are going to have to go up or government spending is going to have to come way down. And those two things will depress economic growth and will cause people right now to say, oh, my taxes are going to go up in the future. I better not spend money. I better save it.
Now, the economists that you talk to who question the idea that the debt is hurting growth, are politicians and policymakers actually listening to them, or are they just frustrated scholars shaking their fists at conventional wisdom?
What I found interesting was that the idea of a tipping point and the idea that the tipping point is at 90% debt to GDP ratio is really widely held in the political world. But among economists, this is still very much a topic of debate, discussion, and dissension. And those who disagree with the notion of a debt tipping point really range across the political spectrum. It's not just a left-right issue.
What's the risk in being wrong about to what extent the debt impacts growth?
Well, my inbox has been filling up with people reminding me of the risks of being wrong,
okay.
Which is, you know, if people were to infer from this that there is no link at all under any circumstances between debt and growth, and we can just run up the national credit card indefinitely without consequences, that could cause a problem down the road, particularly when interest rates come back up to more normal levels. That's going to dramatically inflate our annual interest costs on the debt, and that'll be money that we can't spend on other things we need.
Okay, Bloomberg senior writer David Lynch, thanks so much.
Anytime.
And finally, economic forecasts are imperfect. The same is true for sports. Defying the odds, Florida Gulf Coast University. The team is the first number 15 seed to advance to the NCAA tournament Sweet 16. Before the tourney, Nate Silver gave them a mere 3.3% chance of even making it this far. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
There's a shortage of primary care doctors, as you might have heard, so the nurse practitioner will see you now.
Currently, there are 12 states with active legislation looking at utilizing nurse practitioners at the top of their education to meet patient care needs.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the workplace politics of primary care, next time on Marketplace from APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.